This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
This is Johnny Bluestar. We're back with Robert Snow, a homicide police detective at the time, who after an hypnotic regression became embroiled in another type of investigation involving death, and yes, rebirth into another body, his own. In his first attempted regression with a professional hypnotist, although profoundly skeptical, he found himself transported to a world as real and vivid as this world, only in a different realm of time. The last time being focused in the late 1800s, where he seemed to be an artist. At this point, although he had certain details, he didn't even know the artist's name. Tell me, Robert, when did investigating this become such an obsession, if you like? Well, and eventually almost an absolute commitment.
Well, actually, I went back to life the second time. Dr. Griffith told me, he said, I want you to go back to life you live before you're a Bob Snow. Go back to the last time you're on, before you come for this life. So, there was a couple of moments of gray fog, and all of a sudden I was back in the body, and I could tell I was back in the artist's body again, because I was painting a portrait at that moment. And I noticed, but the interesting part was, my subject, my portrait, was a hunchback woman. And I thought how bizarre that was at the moment. They were doing a portrait of a hunchback woman.
Sure.
But the interesting part was, again, this regression was so vivid, I could see every single brushstroke. I could see I was just finishing the portrait. So I would talk to Dr. Griffith, and again, I'm telling Dr. Griffith, I'm painting a portrait. I hate painting portraits, but I need the money, and on and on. So then Dr. Griffith took me to a couple more episodes in this life. But she told me, I want you to go to 5 years ahead in life. So again, I'm in the gray fog. And again, just before I knew I was going to say anything, all of a sudden I just started talking. I said, she died of a blood clot. The doctor said she died of a blood clot. Now, I had no idea who I was talking about. I had no idea. I'm just talking. I didn't know I was going to talk. But I knew whoever it was. This was a woman supremely important to this artist. I mean, just because I wanted to cry. I could feel a sob come down. And I thought how bizarre that was. I could feel a sob come up. Anyway, after I said this, the recorder I had brought along shut off. It gave a loud click. I had a 60-minute tape, and I opened my eyes, and that was it. That was the end. That was the end of the regression. So now I'm feeling kind of foolish because I'd gone in there all cocksure about what was going to happen. I'd kind of babbled for the last half hour. You know, I feel like an idiot, you know. So Dr. Griffiths asked me, he says, what does this all mean to you? Can you see how this relates to your present life? And really, at the moment, I couldn't. I was too confused. I was kind of flustered and confused about the whole thing.
You went to another world, right?
I still didn't believe it. No, I'm sorry. I still didn't believe it. I thought this was still my subconscious.
But I mean, your experience was something completely out of the ordinary for your own background, right?
I didn't believe it was anything supernatural. I believe it was my subconscious mind playing tricks on me. So anyway, I mumbled something to Dr. Griffith about I need time to think, and I got out of there. But I sat in my car for a little bit, and I'm thinking because, you know, the problem was not that what happened. The problem was how vivid it was. It didn't have the feeling of imagination, of something you just made up. Everything was so clear and vivid, it had the feel of a real story. But, yeah. You know, you're trying to figure what could this be, you know? But I finally told myself, Bob, just forget about it. This was simply memories for your subconscious mind. You're hypnotized. When you're hypnotized, you can actually delve into your subconscious mind. That's all it was. It's memories from this life. Let it go. And I kept telling myself that. But for the next couple of weeks, that's all I'd think about. All I could think about was this regression. And funny, for the first couple of years after the regression, if I closed my eyes, I could still see it just as clear as I was there. I could still see that painting with every brush stroke in it. I could still see the scene very clear. So probably for the next couple of weeks, I would think about it, gosh, dozens of times every day. I'd think about it all the time, constantly. And it started bugging me because I could feel myself becoming obsessed about this. And as a police officer, believe me, I've dealt with people who have obsessions, and seldom does it turn out good for the person. And I could see myself, I could feel myself becoming obsessed about this regression. I thought, this is stupid. I kept telling myself, Bob, this is stupid. This is nothing but your subconscious mind bringing up old memories, reorienting them, and putting them into a story that looks like a real story, but it's not. And no matter how many times I told myself that, and you'll just forget about it, I couldn't. I kept thinking about it. Finally, I could see my eyes become obsessed. I knew I needed to do something about it because, again, obsessions very seldom turn out to be good. I decided, you know what I need to do? I need to find one of these two paintings I'd seen. Because I did, that time I didn't have any names of anybody or anything like that, but I had seen two paintings. And I figured, how many paintings of hunchback women could there be? I figured, yeah. What you need to do is find either this one or the still life. When you see them, then you'll remember where you saw these paintings. Not in a past life. You saw them somewhere in this life. You probably read a little blurb about the artist, and that's where all this stuff come from. So I said,
well, I think it's better for the hunchback than the still life because you'd have a lot to look at.
Yeah, still life, I thought, yeah. I thought, how many hunchback women could have portraits made? Come on. I thought that should be easy to find. So I made this plan. I was going to go to the Indianapolis Public. This was, by the way, this was back in 1992. So this was before the internet. So in those days, when you wanted to research, you couldn't just pull up a search engine and type something in. You had to actually go to the library and pull books off the shelf.
I remember.
So I go to the library. I go to their art section, start thumbing through art books. I mean, how hard? I figured it'd take me a couple hours. I would find either one of the two paintings. It'd all come back to me. Everything would be explained. But like a lot of the best laid plans in the world, it didn't work out like I thought. Actually, the Indianapolis Public Library has hundreds and hundreds of art books. I had no idea they had so many. And it took me several months. But I finally went through every single art book in the Indianapolis Public Library. And I didn't find either painting.
You know, there was another part of it besides the obsession and search for the paintings. Because you speak about your memories of the session being particularly vivid, but even after it was over, you had some very interesting dreams related to past lifetimes, including some of yourself and your brother Fred working together in a studio painting and also in an art gallery. I mean, an artist colony. In one dream, you talk to a little man who tells you something about your mutual past lifetimes. Why do you suppose all that extra stuff is happening too?
See, again, I thought at the time, I thought this is all part of the obsession. This thing has got my hold on me. I thought the dreams, because again, I have a dream constantly about something about the regression. Again, like I saw my brother and I, we were painters working together. I saw my stepdaughter as my daughter in the Greek woman's life. And again, I thought this is all just part of the obsession. That's all it is. It's no real, dreams are just dreams. There's no reality to them. That's what I kept telling myself. It's all part of the obsession. I need to find one of these paintings. Then once you find it and realize, oh yeah, I saw it 6 years ago at an art exhibition, it's all solved. Everything is solved. There's no mystery. There's nothing supernatural. And so that's why I started my research. And after I couldn't find it at the library, I started going to bookstores around the city. I thought, because a lot of times the bookstores had art books that the library didn't have. I went to every book I could find, all the bookstores in Annapolis. Nothing. So I finally thought, well, okay, maybe I need to talk to some art dealers. So I started going to art galleries and art dealers. I figured, surely, God, they'd know about a hunchback woman painting, wouldn't they? But I found out something interesting. In 1992, 90, and 93, at that time, there was no internet, and there was no central list of paintings anywhere. In other words, if you didn't know where a painting was, who had it, there was really not hardly any way of finding it. And so after about 2 or 3 months, of investigation, an intense investigation. I was doing this every lunch hour in the evenings, on weekends. I didn't find anything. I hadn't found a thing.
So at one point, you actually went back for another regression experience, right?
Well, I thought, after a couple months of finding nothing, I thought, well, maybe I need more information on the artist. Maybe I should go back and for another regression, go back, maybe I could find a name or something like that would give me some more information. Then I could find the paintings and remember where I saw them this life. So I went back to Griffith for a second, which wasn't easy after the first time. I was still embarrassed in the first one. But I went back and had a second. And interesting enough, even though I went back to several past lives, I could not get to the artist's life. Every time she'd tell me to go to the artist's life, nothing would happen.
And later on, you actually went into your own experiments with self-hypnosis, and you did come up with one thing, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like I said, Dr. Griffith asked her, I got down to the second session, I asked her, why couldn't I go back to the artist's life? She says, you already know everything you need to know. which later on turned out to be true. At the time, I thought, well, I don't know why it's not true. So finally, what happened, I even visited a couple of, I even visited a New Age bookstore in Indianapolis here. I want to get information on past lives, maybe to find out what happened so I can understand why, you know, where this information came from. And I found some like scripts and a couple of audio tapes that you could do self-hypnosis, which, by the way, turns out to be a lot harder than you think it is. Real hard. But I tried that a couple of times. Actually, I tried about a half dozen times. And only, I think, twice I found myself going into the state I had been in Dr. Griffith's office. But it's funny, it only lasted a few seconds. Then I would see the number 1917 and be like an explosion, and you'd be out of it. It happened to me twice, but I never could go very deep into it.
Well, we're going to take a break now, but when we get back, we're going to tell our audience the most astounding thing that happened in a little city called New Orleans. And so we'll be right back.
Patricia Welch is clearly one of the most accomplished singers living today. Recently, she created a wonderful CD set called Great Entertaining, Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia. We have two complete shows with Patricia, show number 4, Evolution of a Singer, and show number 14, Cocktails with Patricia. You can find them at our Threshold Radio archives at VegasOnNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here's one of her songs.
I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welch for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. To a friend's home for dinner, Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD.
You won't be disappointed.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We can take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, the creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
We're back with retired police officer Robert Snow. In our discussion, we are relating what happened to him and how at some point his investigation with a supposed past lifetime he experienced as an artist while under hypnosis was beginning to give him trouble. And I guess, didn't you sort of quit for a while? Didn't you sort of say, that's it?
Yeah, well, you know, after several months, I couldn't find anything on this thing. And like I said, when I was in charge of homicide, we had 83% clearance rate. But that still means 17% of your murders go unsolved. And because simply you don't have enough evidence to follow through on. And that's what I thought this case was. I just don't have enough evidence. I'm just going to forget about it. And I tried to. I didn't have much luck, and I still thought about it all the time. But anyway, so it was getting close to my wife and I's anniversary, and we were talking about taking a trip somewhere. And she called me one day at work and said, what do you think about going to New Orleans? Sounds fine. I've never been there. She'd never been there. So we booked a trip to New Orleans, and we went through down there for our anniversary, and we had a really good time, and you know, look around New Orleans and all the stuff we did. And anyway, the last day, our plane was then leave till late in the afternoon, so we had most of the day in New Orleans. We decided to kind of window shop in the French Quarter. They have a lot of really neat stores and shops there and everything. So we were doing that. We were window shopping, looking around, and we finally got down to Royal Street. In the early 1990s, Royal Street at that time was mostly art galleries. And we started going through the art galleries, and they had some beautiful paintings and, you know, by very well-known artists and everything. But I noticed as I'm walking down the street, Royal Street, that the galleries are getting smaller and the paintings are getting more obscure. And we finally got to the very end of Royal Street, and there's a little art gallery. We go into it. It's two-story, and it said modern art on the second floor. My wife likes modern art. I never have. So she goes to the second floor. And I walk along the first floor of the thing, look at the paintings. I don't recognize any of the paintings. I don't recognize any of the artists, but I'm just looking at everything. So I get to the corner and start to go, and there's a portrait hanging out, standing on the easel in the corner. So I turn, and I glance, and I walk by, and kind of like I walked into a glass wall. I spun around, and it was the portrait of the Hunchback Woman. Now, wow. You know, I was a police officer for a lot of years, and I've been involved in a lot of scary situations where I've been frightened a number of times. I don't think I've ever been quite as frightened as I was at this moment. One, because as a police officer, even if you're in frightening, scary situations, you have training, and you have experience, and you know what your best actions should be and what the actions of the other people are going to be, and so you feel a little confident. But this case, I had no experience, no training. I didn't know what to do. I turned around and I stared, and I looked, and it was for a moment. It was so surreal. I kind of wondered, am I really here? Am I really here? Maybe I'm in a nursing home somewhere. You know, I'm in a nursing home or a hospital. I've had a stroke, and this is a hallucination, because things like this might happen on the X-Files. It might happen in a movie and TVs. Things like this don't happen to people in real life. They just don't happen. Then I kept staring to Patriot. I kept telling myself, no, what it is, this looks like it's close, but it's not the same one. So I closed my eyes, and I could still see the regression. I could see the painting. And I opened my eyes, and it was the same painting. It was simply. And so I stood there for several minutes. I didn't know what to do. I don't think I've ever been quite that frightened, even when I was a police officer, because, again, the problem was I had no experience, nothing to work with, what do you do in this situation? Here's a painting that I saw in a regression. I've been hunting for months, couldn't find anything, and to stumble on it by accident in a city 1,000 miles from home. What are the odds of that happening? They're astronomical.
It makes you think that maybe it wasn't an accident.
Well, yeah, later it did. At the moment, I did. At the moment, I'm trying to find some rational reason for this. There's got to be some rational explanation for this. There just has to be. And I just kept staring. So anyway, I kept staring at the painting. Apparently, one of the salesmen thought, hot dog, you figured I had a sale here, see? So after a couple minutes of me just sitting, standing, staring at this painting, trying to figure out what am I going to do? You know, what is this, you know, what's going on? The salesman went and said, hey, I bet you're thinking how nice I look over your fireplace, aren't you? And kind of startled me out of it. So I thought, okay, you know, fine, Bob, but whatever happened, you need to find out about this painting, find out the artist. So I asked the dealer, I says, I don't recognize the painting of the artist. Who painted this? He said, hold on a second. He said, I got a little bio here. So he goes over to his desk and he pulls out a piece of paper and it's got a little bio and it said, painting was J. Carroll Beckwith. And interesting enough, it said he was born 1852, died in 1917. And of course, the minute I seen that, it's like electric shock running through you because I remember the self-hypnosis, the number 1917. And I thought, Bob, quit it. You're being silly. You're trying to find stuff that's not there. So I read the bio, and immediately I saw there were five things in the bio that matched my regression. And again, it's one of these things where, you know, I'm so stunned, I don't know what to do. But then I'm thinking, wait a minute, I know what this is. You've seen this painting somewhere in this life. You read a little bio about the artist at the bottom. This is where it's all coming from. There's nothing supernatural. I mean, finding the painting in New Orleans was one heck of a coincidence, extraordinary coincidence, but there's nothing supernatural. So I said, told the dealer, I said, hey, I've seen this painting somewhere before. He says, has it been an exhibition in a museum somewhere? He said, no. He said, let me be honest. He said, this painting's been in a private collection for years and years. He said, let me be honest with you. He said, Beckwith wasn't that famous, so I can let this go pretty cheap. But unfortunately, I didn't know what to say. I'm just so flustered and stunned. I didn't know what to do. Fortunately, that moment, my wife came down from upstairs and asked me ready to go. And so I mumbled something to the dealer about it. Let me think about it. And we left. But the good thing was when we left, I thought, well, now I have information. I have a name. I have dates of birth and date of death. I can go back to Indianapolis. I can research J. Carroll Beckwith. Then I'll find out where I saw him in this life. I mean, this all is one heck of a coincidence. I mean, it's pretty bizarre. But I could live with that if I could just explain to myself where I had seen him in this life.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things when I heard an interview with you before was that I used to actually work in an art gallery on Royal Street in New Orleans. But that was quite some time before you came there. But New Orleans is a very magical place anyway, and I had some really interesting experiences there. Now, after your initial shock at finding the Hunchback painting and the artist's name and bio was over with, and you realized you could not actually have seen this painting before with the recognition of the incredible odds that you mentioned, did you at all feel at this point that maybe there was, or even speculate, that there was some kind of intelligent guidance that you never knew existed before?
No, I was still convinced this time there was a rational, down-to-earth explanation for this. I just had to find it. So I went back to Indianapolis, and I went to the public library, and I started doing research on this J. Carroll Beckwith. And interesting enough, the library helped me. There wasn't hardly anything on him. I mean, the small books on artists was nothing. The very, very large book on artists, there'd be maybe a couple sentences about him. He was a portrait painter who lived in New York in the late 1800s, early 1900s, never painted any painting of significance. He made his living painting portraits. But interesting enough, you know, that's what concerned me was, if it's just this little about him, how could I have stumbled information about him? And I mean, there was hardly anything about him. But anyway, so the librarian there at the public library told me, says, I tell you what you need to do. He said, why don't you go up to the art museum library? They have a much more extensive art library up there. They do much more art research. So I thought, good idea. So I drove up north side of Annapolis to the art museum, went to their library, and told the librarian that I was researching J. Carroll Beckwith. And so she found me some more information about him. Not a whole lot more. Maybe another, you know, couple paragraphs or two. But the interesting part was, every little bit I found kept substantiating something I'd seen in the regression. Little small points about like I found a thing in the art museum said that he painted portraits but hated painted portraits. And I remember saying that to Dr. Griffith type thing. And it, you know, I kept finding one little point after another. It was really kind of, I didn't know what to do. I kept looking for something that was wrong, you know, something that wasn't true. Then I could say, well, see, this is all baloney. But I kept finding one confirmation another. But interesting enough, during one of the books was on, it was actually about the famous painter, American painter, James Singer Sargent, who turned out was he and Beckwith went to art school together and were roommates in Paris for 5 years. And so they said this anecdote, I bet there's a little footnote at the bottom of the book, said this anecdote came from the diaries of J. Carroll Beckwith that are kept on file at the National Academy of Design in New York City.
Well, we're going to find out what happened then in just a couple of minutes. But we're going to take a break now. And here's some information about the incredible compositional artistry of my friend and colleague, Russian composer Edgar Ahrens. I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I'm very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
Following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here, there's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped 2 hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
Hi, this is Johnny Bluestar back on Threshold Radio with
Robert Snow, a retired Indianapolis homicide detective and commander of their division, and also a author of something called Portrait of a Lifetime of a Past Lifetime Skeptic. And at this point, Robert went to the Central Library in Indianapolis, and he didn't find everything that he wanted, but was suggested to go to the Indianapolis Museum Library. And there he began to get a few more clues. And also he found a book by John Singer Sargent, which contained references to something that was very interesting evidentially. What did you find there?
Well, again, the footnote said that this anecdote about Sargent came from the diaries of J. Carroll Beckwith, which were at the National Academy of Design. Another footnote said that this anecdote came from the unpublished autobiography of J. Carroll Beckwith, also at the National Design. So I realized at that point I had already verified about 10 points I had seen in the regression. It was starting to really bug me. And what I was looking for at this point wasn't more verification. I was looking for one or two things I had said during the regression that weren't true. I thought if I could find one or two things about Beckwith that weren't true, I had said weren't true, that means it's not a real memory then. This is some kind of messed up thing. It's not true. So that's what I was really searching for. So what I did is I actually sent a letter to Nash County Design, asked if I could see the diaries. And they said, well, we don't loan them out. They're too fragile. But they are on microfilm that you could order through an interlibrary loan. So I did that. I asked an interlibrary loan for his diaries. Well, they came, and I got kind of a shock when I took them to the microfilm room and opened up. He kept his diary from age 19 up to the day before he died at age 65, over 17,000 pages of diary.
So, don't you think that maybe in some way, considering that much of writing, that he was kind of a writer too himself?
Yeah,
maybe
he
not
did.
Professional, but he was into writing.
He very much was. Actually, at the end of his life, matter of fact, when he was really sick, he couldn't paint any longer. He was sick and couldn't stand up. He decided to become a writer. And he actually had several things published in writing magazines. But anyway, So I look at this 17,000 pages and think, what am I going to do? I mean, you could have 2 weeks, but how are you going to go to 17,000 pages? You can't.
That's like For War and Peace by Tolstoy or something.
Exactly. So after a couple times of trying to find stuff in there, I looked at some of the tapes, and but I couldn't go deep into them. I eventually ended up having hard copy made of the 17,000 pages. I had it made into hard copy, and it took me over a year. At every night and weekend evening, I read every single page of his diary, all 17,000 pages. And now, interesting enough, he also did an autobiography, but he started this in the spring of 1917 when he was sick. He had endocarditis, which is infection of the heart valves, which makes you very weak and sick. And so he only got 20 pages done on that. So there wasn't much value to that. So again, what I'm looking through in his diary, I'm looking for the one or two things that are not true. For example, I told Dr. Griffith that what I regret about the life is that we didn't have children because my wife couldn't have children. I thought, well, if he had children, then that's it, isn't it? Then this is all some kind of gobbled up mess. It's not true. So I started looking, and I'd seen him drinking wine. I thought, well, suppose he's a teetotaler. And I was always under the impression in the late 1800s that men who drank whiskey. They didn't drink wine. I thought, if he didn't drink wine, that's fine. I had said that someone, a woman very important to him, would die of a blood clot. I thought, well, if nobody here very important had died of blood clot, again, this is all garbage. This is not true, not real. So, again, I started going through the diary. But like with the little facts of the library, rather than find the fact it wasn't true, I kept finding one little thing after another that was true. For example, I had saw him when I described him, Dr. Griffith, I'd seen him with a fancy walking stick. I thought it wasn't a cane, it's a fancy walking stick. Well, I found a number of pictures of him with fancy walk stick and him mentioned in a diary a number of times about the fancy walking stick. And interesting enough, when I got on October 24th, 1888, which coincidentally is 29 years to the day before he died, his wife had a very, very difficult miscarriage. And because of it, she couldn't have children. And interesting enough, he mentioned his diary a number of times, how much he would have loved to have had children, but his wife couldn't have children.
Right.
I kept finding one little thing after another. It wasn't the denying. I kept looking for the one denying fact that I could prove wasn't wrong. And I up to the very last, I was determined I was going to find it. But then I got to December 5th, 1886. And he tells, they were interesting enough before I get into that. Let me tell you, I realized that I told you there were about a woman dying of blood clot. I knew that after reading enough of his diary, that was only two women, his wife, who he loved dearly, and his mother, who he just adored. His mother was the only person who encouraged him to be an artist. His dad had always told him that being an artist is the best way he knew of starving to death. His dad never tried to encourage him to be an artist, but his mother had, and he adored his mother. So I figured it had to be one of those two women. Well, when I got to the diary to December 5th, 1886, he writes that his mother's in church and had a stroke due to a blood clot and died.
Wow.
You know, I think that was the one that kind of pushed me over the edge. I realized then I'm not going to find the denying fact. I'm going to find every fact. As a matter of fact, stepping back a minute, when I ordered the tapes, I thought, I'm going to look for the denying factor. So I went through my tape I had made of my regression, and I started listing everything could be proven or not proven. And I found there were 28 things I'd said about this artist's life that could be proved or not proved. Like, say, for example, cause of death, about not having children. There were 28 different things I'd said that could be proved or not proved.
Right.
And so my thought was to find a couple of them that weren't true. In the end, I end up confirming all 28 facts about Beckwith.
It's just amazing. I mean, can I be honest with you? I mean, it seems to me if you missed two of them, you'd still have a statistical probability that something real had happened, right?
Yeah, I know, but I was not ready to do that. But again, I had lived my life looking for facts and hard evidence. I wasn't looking for supernatural, otherworldly things. I was not willing to accept this unless I had absolute 100% proof. Now, the odds you could, if I had 28 things, the odds you could guess, half dozen I'm right, it's not that unusual. You could make some, because like I kept trying to tell myself, okay, I told you that I went under my regression, I thought it was fall, late fall, when I saw him die. Well, he died October 24th, it was late fall. Okay, I thought, I reasoned myself, okay, a fourth of people who die every year die in the fall. I had seen him die in a large city. I thought, awful lot of people die in large cities. This is how I kept trying to rationalize myself. Every fact I found, I kept trying to rationalize. Yeah, okay. I rose above my body above a large city. He died in New York City. But awful lot of people do, not just him. I kept thinking, that doesn't mean anything, Bob. Awful lot of people die in New York City. Awful lot of people die in the fall. You know, and this kind of thing. I kept trying to rationalize every time I'd find something, how that wasn't any proof. It was just something that, you know, okay, it matches it, but it's not necessarily proof. It wasn't until I found the thing about his wife having the miscarriage and not being able to have children, and more than that, his mother dying of blood clot, that really decided it for me.
Well, you know, on this program, which is kind of a spiritually oriented program, I've noticed that people, you know, who have these experiences, they're coming often from a place where they're pretty much, it's just an ordinary life. And then suddenly something thrusts them into, you could call it the Twilight Zone. And the whole nature of reality starts to change. Tell me, after your first edition was published back in 1999, and you were working as, the commander of this division, I believe, this homicide division in mm-hmm. the police department, what was the public reaction and also the reaction of publishers and especially the reaction of your police department?
Well, you know, I'd got a lot of warning from a lot of people, my wife, my agent, and other people, about if I publish this book, it's going to cause me problems. Before this, I had a dozen or so books published. They were all about police procedure, about SWAT teams, about sex crime investigation, about child abuse, various things police did, very police-oriented, procedural type books. And my agent and everyone was afraid that if I published this book, no one would take me serious again about writing serious police subjects. My wife was really worried about how the police department would react. How would they, what would they think about it? And unfortunately, both my agent and my wife turned out to be right. It didn't go well either way. It didn't go well at the police department. It didn't go well with my publisher. It took me 5 years because I was having a book published every year before this. As a matter of fact, a couple of years, I had two books published in 1 year. Then it took me 5 years after the publication of this book before I was able to get another book contract.
Well, how did you do that? I mean, what happened with that?
I think enough time passes, everybody forgets. You can give, everybody forgets. and you get back, you can get back in the game again. I think enough.
Well, it's certainly a sensation. I didn't read the first edition; I read the last one, but it's certainly sensational. I mean, it's just an amazing book, and particularly, you know, the fact is that you check off in the most torturous way all these 28 different points with all kinds of coincidences leading you to being able to do that in the first place. So was it worth it, considering the effect on your career?
You know, because actually, it didn't, like I said, let me finish up the thing about the police department. It didn't go well there either.
Yeah.
It really didn't. I mean, this is not, I mean, police captains are the backbone of any police department. Yeah, all your chiefs and deputy chiefs, that's not your rank. That's an appointed rank. You're actually a captain, and you get appointed to these ranks, and when you get down and they get tired of you, or a new administration comes in, you go back to being captain again. And so a police captain is the backbone of the police department. And like my wife told me, maybe you might believe in this, police captains don't go talking about it. She told me, just shut up, take us to the grave with me. Because she had investigated, when I first told my wife about this, she decided to investigate it too to see. She thought I had read something about Beckwith or found information about it somewhere else. I've just forgot it. And so she actually investigated herself, and she couldn't find anything. But regardless, she told me, just shut up about it, Bob. The department is not going to take it well. And they didn't. No, they didn't. As a matter of fact, they tried to force me into retirement because of it.
Yeah.
Because I think they thought this is not something they want when their captain's talking about publicly.
Yeah, but you know, you had put so much into that career, and you had been so successful. And then now you're suddenly in a different realm of reality. And it's a reality that's quite detached from ordinary reality, and so people just completely freak out.
Well, the point was, like you said, actually finding the Hunchback wasn't the only time during this litigation when information about Beckwith was just literally dumped in my lap by what looked like a startling coincidence. It happened several times during my investigation. And so, you start looking at things, you think, this is much too important. This information came from somewhere. I didn't know where, but it came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Whoever's in charge of the universe wants you to write this book. Because I kept finding information just dumped in my lap. I mean, it was really, all of a sudden come out of nowhere, there'd be more information about Beckwith. And it's like, well, Bob, who's ever in charge of the universe wants this book written, wants you to do it. Now, is it going to cost me professionally? And it did. It did cost me professionally at the police department and as a writer. But I felt like the book was important enough that it needed to be published. I really need to tell my story.
I really think that you especially for me, because I think it was worth it just so I could read it. But that's being too selfish. I think everybody should take a look at this book. We'll be back in a minute and conclude our discussion and tell you more about how to get a hold of the book and some of Bob's reflections.
Originally, Zave Nathan came here from France seeking work as an actor and musician in Hollywood. Now, he and his wife, Bonnie Blazek, write unusual and impactful songs, often addressing critical issues facing humanity. You can hear their story and some of their exciting music in show number 3 with Zave Nathan and Bonnie Blazek in our Threshold Radio archives in VegasAllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here is one of their songs.
All day, you're so tired at night. You wonder why your sex drive is gone. Your table dinner is waiting for you. You grab the remote and turn on the mute. And then your box is telling you what to buy. Television, television, it must be the way out of this. Television, television, another life falling out of grace. Mm-hmm.
Roots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of the stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in his stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall.
We're back on Threshold Radio with our last few moments with Robert Snow, author of Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic and a former commander of the Homicide Division of the Indianapolis Police, one of the most exciting interviews I've ever had. Tell us, Robert, a little bit about your current thoughts on reincarnation. What have you learned that isn't in your books?
Well, you know, actually finding the proof of it wasn't the hard part. I mean, I kept finding one thing after, you know, I had these 28 facts. I kept checking them off one after another, another. And you finally get all 28 checked off. That wasn't the hard part, accepting what I had proven. What the hard part was accepting what this means to your worldview. In other words,
yes.
I had to look, stand back and look and realize that the worldview I'd held my whole life was wrong. That the world didn't operate on the parameters I thought it operated on. And the people I had always kind of rolled my eyes at and snickered were right and I was wrong. And that, to me, that took longer than anything to actually come about and get and kind of formulate and accept a whole new world view of how the world works.
Did you ever think your books would be found in a New Age bookstore?
No, I didn't. No, I must admit, no, I didn't. When I first started becoming a writer, because before I wrote books, I had over 100 articles and short stories published in various magazines, and they were all in police magazines and other very established magazines. And I had I never thought I'd be in a New Age bookstore ever.
What did you think about the connection between this man, Beckwith, and your own life? Do you feel that there was a connection, a continuity of any type?
There is, and it's, again, it's one of those things. You don't put everything in a book because it looks like you're trying to force feed people. But there were so many parallels between Beckwith's life and mine. It's really amazing. It really is. But again, I felt like if you put too much in the book, people think, God, he's trying to force us. You know, you're trying to force feed to this stuff.
Could you share a little bit of that with us?
Well, it's, you know, like I said, when Beckwith at the last part of his life, again, he was so weak he couldn't stand up anymore because he had endocarditis, which what eventually killed him. And so for the last year or two, he decided to become a writer. And he has stuff published. And again, from my very first memories, that's the only thing I ever wanted to be. It's kind of like a continuity.
Yeah, definitely.
On forward from him, you know, from him to me type thing. And I was telling you about the various coincidences. In Beckwith's diaries, he mentions a number of times about scrapbooks, about how he's working on a scrapbook. I could not find out where they were at. I could not find the information. Everybody I checked, you know, all the resources, nobody knew where his scrapbooks were at. Of course, he wasn't that famous. So there's not much recorded about him. He wasn't, you know, that famous or that good. So anyway, I talked to an art dealer, and he was actually in New York. And he was telling me, he said, well, you know, there's an awful lot of fraud in American art. So I have an expert in American art. She might have some information about Beckwith for you.
Really?
And so her and I, so he gave me to her, and her and I are talking about something else. And out of the blue, no, I didn't ask her anything. anything yet. She told me, says, you know his scrapbooks are to New York Historical Society, right? And it just caught me by surprise because I hadn't asked her anything about scrapbooks. Or anything. We were just talking, just started talking. I hadn't mentioned a word to anyone. I hadn't mentioned to the art dealer himself or anyone about the scrapbooks. And she, again, it was one thing she just kind of blurted out real sudden and said, do you know what scrapbooks are to the New York Historical Society? Things like this kept happening about Beckwith, where information, again, would just be dumped in my lap.
So would you say, Bob, that you were kind of being guided?
Yeah, oh yeah, very obviously so. Now, when I look back on it, at the time I didn't. At the time I kept resisting thinking that. But as I look back on it now, most certainly something was guiding me, something pushing me toward this. Because actually, there were several times writing this when I would get worried. I would listen to what my wife said. She said, boy, the police department's not going to like this. You're going to get in trouble. And several times I actually thought, I'm not going to do this. I've changed my mind. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to write this book. I'm going to send back the advance and go on writing other, because I had other subjects I was working on and police, actually were police oriented. Then right. Something bizarre happened. For example, one day I had decided, I'm not going to write this anymore. That's it. I'm not going to write it. This is silly. I'm going to ruin my police career, ruin my writing career. That morning I decided, I got a call from a lady who was a researcher for the Berry Hill Art Gallery in New York City. And she said, I heard you're asking about, you're doing research on Beckwith, because I had card number art dealers about him, like I said, I told you about
it. Right, sure.
And she said, I hear your sister. She said, I want to know, have you found where some of his paintings are? Because again, at this time still, there was no internet, so central listing of paintings. I says, yeah, I found a number of paintings. Why? She said, well, Berry Hill Gallery is going to have an exhibition of his work. We've been planning this for a couple of years.
Wow.
And the interesting, not the, but the really interesting part is, it was the art exhibit was coming, was opening on the very same day my book was going to be released.
Really?
Yeah, the exact same day.
Did you go?
Yeah, I did eventually. Yes, I did go see it. But the interesting part is, I asked her, I said, wait a minute. I said, Beckwith's paintings have never been in demand. He wasn't that good a painter. Why would he have an exhibition of his work? And she said, you know, I don't know. So I don't remember. Said, somebody mentioned it a couple of years ago. We decided to do it. Interesting enough, they had an exhibition there for 30 days. They sold zero paintings. Didn't sell a single one. But he simply wasn't that good or that famous.
Well, what did you think of his paintings yourself? I mean, did you like them?
Yeah, okay. I'm not an art aficionado. I don't know too much about art. But again, he was competent enough to make a living as a portrait painter, but not so great that people would remember him.
Right now, Robert, we're about to leave, but I want you to give some contact information about your website or how to get order one of your books before we leave.
Any Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all of them have my book. It's by Lou Allen, a publisher there in Minneapolis. You can get it on Amazon, like I said, Barnes & Noble. And I have a website on Amazon. If you type my name into Amazon search engine, it'll take you to my Amazon website, which lists not only this book, but all my other books, too.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And it's been, as I say, one of the most exciting times I've had. Well, everybody, join us again on Threshold Radio next week, Saturday, 10 to noon on Pacific time. And we're going to go out with a wonderful rendition by Patricia Welch of the classic Night and Day.
Of you. Night and day, day and night, why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you. Torment won't spend my life making love to